Chapter 23. After a few more dumb, leaden-footed minutes, while Flora was putting on her hat and jacket, the Fiends, without moving, without saying anything, saw these two leave the room. "She never looked back at us," said Mrs. Fine. "He just followed them out. I've never had such a crushing impression of the miserable dependence of girls of women. This was an extreme case. But a young man, any man could have gone to break stones on the roads, or something of that kind, or enlisted, or, it was very true. Women can't go forth on the high roads, and by ways to pick up a living even when dignity, independence, or existence itself are at stake. But what made me interrupt Mrs. Fine's tirade was my profound surprise at the fact of that respectable citizen being so willing to keep in his home the poor girl for whom it seemed there was no place in the world. And not only willing but anxious. I couldn't credit him with generous impulses. For it seemed obvious to me from what I had learned that, to put it mildly, he was not an impulsive person. I confess that I can't understand his motive," I exclaimed. "This is exactly what John wondered at first," said Mrs. Fine. By that time an intimacy, if not exactly confidence, had sprung up between us which permitted her in this discussion to refer to her husband as John. "Oh no, he had not opened his lips all that time," she pursued. "Don't blame his restraint. On the contrary. What could he have said? I could see he was observing the man very thoughtfully. And so, Mr. Fine listened, observed, and meditated," I said. "That's an excellent way of coming to a conclusion. And may I ask at what conclusion he had managed to arrive? On what ground did he cease to wonder at the inexplicable? For I can't admit humanity to be the explanation. It would be too monstrous." "It was nothing of the sort," Mrs. Fine assured me with some resentment, as though I had aspersed little Fine's sanity. Fine very sensibly had set himself the mental task of discovering the self-interest. I should not have thought him capable of so much cynicism. He said to himself that for people of that sort, religious fears, or the vanity of righteousness put aside, money not great wealth, but money, just a little money, is the measure of virtue, of expediency, of wisdom, of pretty well everything. But the girl was absolutely destitute. The father was in prison after the most terribly complete and disgraceful smash of modern times. And then it dawned upon Fine that this was just it. The great smash, in the great dust of vanishing millions. Was it possible that they all had vanished to the last penny? Wasn't there, somewhere, something palpable, some fragment of the fabric left? "That's it," had exclaimed Fine, startling his wife by this explosive unseating of his lips less than half an hour after the departure of DeBarrell's cousin with DeBarrell's daughter. It was still in the dining room, very near the time for him to go forth affronting the elements in order to put in another day's work in his country's service. All he could say at the moment in elucidation of this breakdown from his usual placid solemnity was, "The fellow imagines that DeBarrell has got some plunder put away somewhere." This being the theory arrived at by Fine, his comment on it was that a good many bankrupts had been known to have taken such a precaution. It was possible in DeBarrell's case. Fine went so far in his display of cynical pessimism as to say that it was extremely probable. He explained at length to Mrs. Fine that DeBarrell certainly did not take anyone into his confidence. But the beastly relative had made up his low mind that it was so. He was selfish and pitiless in his stupidity, but he had clearly conceived the notion of making a claim on DeBarrell when DeBarrell came out of prison on the strength of having hooked after, as he would have himself expressed it, his daughter. He nursed his hopes, such as they were, in secret, and it is to be supposed kept them even from his wife. I could see it very well. That belief accounted for his mysterious air, while he interfered in favor of the girl. He was the only protectress he had. It was as though Flora had been fated to be always surrounded by treachery and lies, stifling every better impulse, every instinctive aspiration of her soul to trust and to love. It would have been enough to drive a fine nature into the madness of universal suspicion into any sort of madness. I don't know how far a sense of humor will stand by one. To the foot of the gallows, perhaps. But from my recollection of Florida Barrel, I feared that S.E. hadn't much sense of humor. S.E. had cried at the desertion of the absurd fine dog. That animal was certainly free from duplicity. He was frank and simple and ridiculous. The indignation of the girl at his unhypocritical behavior had been funny but not humorous. As you may imagine, I was not very anxious to resume the discussion on the justice, expediency, effectiveness or whatnot, of Fine's journey to London. It isn't that I was unfaithful to little Fine out in the porch with the dog.
They kept amazingly quiet there. Could they have gone to sleep?
What I felt was that either my sagacity or my conscience would come out damaged from that campaign. And no man will willingly put himself in the way of moral damage. I did not want a war with Mrs. Fine. I much preferred to hear something more of the girl, I said. And so she went away with that respectable ruffian. Mrs. Fine moved her shoulders slightly. What else could she have done?
I agreed with her by another hopeless gesture. It isn't so easy for a girl like Florida Barrel to become a factory hand, a pathetic seamstress, or even a barmaid. She wouldn't have known how to begin. She was the captive of the meanest conceivable fate, and she wasn't mean enough for it. It is to be remarked that a good many people are born curiously unfitted for the fate awaiting them on this earth. As I don't want you to think that I am unduly partial to the girl, we shall say that she failed decidedly to endear herself to that simple, virtuous, and, I believe, teetotal household. It's my conviction that an angel would have failed likewise. It's no use going into details. Suffice it to state that before the year was out, she was again at the Fine's door. This time she was escorted by a stout youth. His large pale face wore a smile of inane cunning soured by annoyance. His clothes were new, and the indescribable smartness of their cut, a genre which had never been obtruded on her notice before, astonished Mrs. Fine, who came out into the hall with her hat on, for she was about to go out to hear a new pianist, a girl, in a friend's house. The youth, addressing Mrs. Fine, easily begged her not to let that silly thing go back to us any more. There had been, he said, nothing but ructions at home about her for the last 3 weeks. Everybody in the family was heartily sick of quarreling. His governor had charged him to bring her to this address, and say that the lady and gentleman were quite welcome to all there was in it. As he hadn't enough sense to appreciate a plain, honest English home, and she was better out of it. The young, pimply-faced fellow was vexed by this job his governor had sprung on him. It was the cause of his missing an appointment for that afternoon with a certain young lady, the lady he was engaged to. But he meant to dash back and try for a sight of her that evening yet if he were to burst over it. Goodbye, Flory. Good luck to you, and I hope I'll never see your face again. With that he ran out in lover-like haste, leaving the hall door wide open. Mrs. Fine had not found a word to say. S.E. had been too much taken aback even to gasp freely. But S.E. had the presence of mind to grab the girl's arm just as she, too, was running out into the street with T.E. haste, I suppose, of despair and to keep I don't know what tragic tryst. You stopped her with your own hand, Mrs. Fine, I said. Presume she meant to get away. That girl is no comedian, if I am any judge. Yes. I had to use some force to drag her in. Mrs. Fine had no difficulty in stating the truth. You see, I was in the very act of letting myself out when these two appeared. So that, when that unpleasant young man ran off, I found myself alone with Flora. It was all I could do to hold her in the hall, while I called to the servants to come and shut the door. As is my habit, or my weakness, or my gift, I don't know which, I visualized the story for myself. I really can't help it. And the vision of Mrs. Fine dressed for a rather special afternoon function, engaged in wrestling with a wild-eyed, white-faced girl had a certain dramatic fascination.
Really? I murmured. Oh, there's no doubt that she struggled, said Mrs. Fine. She compressed her lips for a moment and then added, as to her being a comedian, that's another question.
Mrs. Fine had returned to her attitude of folded arms. I saw before me the daughter of the refined poet accepting life whole with its unavoidable conditions, of which one of the first is the instinct of self-preservation and the egoism of every living creature. The fact remains nevertheless that you yourself have, in your own words, pulled her in, I insisted in a jocular tone, with a serious intention.
What was one to do? Exclaimed Mrs. Fine with almost comic exasperation.
Were you reproaching me with being too impulsive?
And she went on telling me that she was not that in the least.
One of the recommendations she always insisted on to the girlfriends, I imagine, was to be on guard against impulse.
Always. But I had not been there to see the face of Flora at the time. If I had, it would be haunting me to this day. Nobody unless made of iron would have allowed a human being with a face like that to rush out alone into the streets.
And doesn't it haunt you, Mrs. Fine?
I asked.
No, not now, she said implacably. Perhaps if I had let her go it might have done.
Don't conclude, though, that I think she was playing a comedy then, because after struggling at first she ended by remaining. She gave up very suddenly. She collapsed in our arms, mine and the maids who came running up in response to my calls, and the door was then shut, I completed the phrase in my own way.
Yes, the door was shut, Mrs. Fine lowered, and raised her head slowly.
I did not ask her for details. Of one thing I am certain, and that is that Mrs. Fine did not go out to the musical function that afternoon. She was no doubt considerably annoyed at missing the privilege of hearing privately an interesting young pianist, a girl who, since, had become one of the recognized performers.
Mrs. Fine did not dare leave her house. As to the feelings of little Fine, when he came home from the office, via his club, just half an hour before dinner, I have no information. But I venture to affirm that in the main they were kindly, though it is quite possible that in the first moment of surprise he had to keep down a swear word or two. The long and the short of it all is that next day the Fines made up their minds to take into their confidence a certain wealthy old lady. With certain old ladies the passing years bring back a sort of mellow youthfulness of feeling, an optimistic outlook, liking for novelty, readiness for experiment. The old lady was very much interested.
Oh, let me see the poor thing. She was accordingly allowed to see Flora de Barrel in Mrs. Fine's drawing room on a day when there was no one else there, and she preached to her with charming sympathetic authority.
The only way to deal with our troubles, my dear child, is to forget them.
You must forget yours.
It's very simple.
Look at me. I always forget mine.
At your age one ought to be cheerful.
Later on when left alone with Mrs. Fine she said to that lady,
do hope the child will manage to be cheerful.
I can't have sad faces near me.
At my age one needs cheerful companions.
And in this hope she carried off Flora de Barrel to Bournemouth for the winter months in the quality of reader and companion.
As he had said to her with kindly jocularity,
ye shall have a good time together.
I am not a grumpy old woman.
But on their return to London she sought Mrs. Fine at once.
As he had discovered that Flora was not naturally cheerful.
When she made efforts to be it was still worse.
The old lady couldn't stand the strain of that.
And then, to have the whole thing out, she could not bear to have for a companion anyone who did not love her.
She was certain that Flora did not love her.
Why? She couldn't say.
Moreover, as he had caught the girl looking at her in a peculiar way at times.
Oh no! It was not an evil look, it was an unusual expression which one could not understand.
And when one remembered that her father was in prison shut up together with a lot of criminals, and so on, it made one uncomfortable.
If the child had only tried to forget her troubles.
but she obviously was incapable or unwilling to do so. And that was somewhat perverse, wasn't it? Upon the whole, she thought it would be better perhaps, Mrs. Fine assented hurriedly to the unspoken conclusion. H. Certainly. Certainly, wondering to herself what was to be done with Flora next. But she was not very much surprised at the change in the old lady's view of Flora DeBarrel. She almost understood it. What came next was a German family, the continental acquaintances of the wife of one of Fine's colleagues in the home office. Flora, of the enigmatical glances, was dispatched to them without much reflection. As it was not considered absolutely necessary to take them into full confidence, they neither expected the girl to be specially cheerful, nor were they discomposed unduly by the indescribable quality of her glances. The German woman was quite ordinary. There were two boys to look after. They were ordinary too, I presume, and Flora, I understand, was very attentive to them. If she taught them anything, it must have been by inspiration alone, for she certainly knew nothing of teaching. But it was mostly conversation which was demanded from her. Flora DeBarrel conversing with two small German boys, regularly, industriously, conscientiously, in order to keep herself alive in the world which held for her the past we know, and the future of an even more undesirable quality, seems to me a very fantastic combination. But I believe it was not so bad. She was being, she wrote, mercifully drugged by her task. As he had learned to converse all day long, mechanically, absently, as if in a trance. An uneasy trance it must have been. Her worst moments were when off duty alone in the evening, shut up in her own little room, her dull thoughts waking up slowly till she started into the full consciousness of her position, like a person waking up in contact with something venomous, a snake, for instance, experiencing a mad impulse to fling the thing away, and run off screaming to hide somewhere. At this period of her existence, Flora DeBarrel used to write to Mrs. Fine not regularly but fairly often. I don't know how long she would have gone on conversing, and, incidentally, helping to supervise the beautifully stocked linen closets of that well-to-do German household, if the man of it had not developed in the intervals of his avocations. He was a merchant, and a thoroughly domesticated character, a psychological resemblance to the Bournemouth old lady. It appeared that he, too, wanted to be loved. He was not, however, of a conquering temperament, a kiss-snatching, door-bursting type of libertine. In the very act of straying from the path of virtue, he remained a respectable merchant. It would have been perhaps better for Flora if he had been a mere brute. But he set about his sinister enterprise in a sentimental, cautious, almost paternal manner, and thought he would be safe with a pretty Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.